Former head of British Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, Richard Dearlove, said that UK is engaged in a grey war with Russia, but the British are not aware of it. What does it mean, grey war?
Well, I guess he's wanting to say it's taking place where nobody can see it, and you're not even sure what the nature of the fight is. What we do know for a fact is that a British naval officer has been assisting the Ukrainians in carrying out maritime drone attacks on the Black Sea Fleet. We know that there have been reportedly British Special Air Service personnel that have been guarding Zelensky to protect him from being killed. There were probably some maintenance crews that were attached to some of the artillery pieces and tanks. Beyond that, the United Kingdom, Britain, does have a long history going back over 70 years of trying to stir up and foment insurrection and attacks against the Soviet Union, and it's continued to this day against Russians. So, but the Brits are a joke. I mean, dear love's a buffoon. They can't even get, they can't deploy their own aircraft carrier. They've had to shut down ships because they didn't have enough crew. They had a submarine fail to launch, the ejectile dysfunction of one of their nuclear missile mock-ups. Their army, standing army now, is smaller than the army of King George when they were fighting the American colonialists, my ancestors, 200 and some years ago. So Britain is, there's a saying in Texas, about being all hat, no cowboy, it's all hat, no horse. It just, they're talking. And that's, Dearlove's good at talking, but they're not very good at doing.
In Spiegel, we see a piece that is explaining that Baerbock is working on the transfer of Taurus missiles to Ukraine in order to bypass the German chancellor. What's going on in Germany right now?
Yes, so this is the same Annalena Baerbock who talked about a reverse position and described it as the 360. So she has trouble doing basic geometry. She doesn't understand that a 360 is a circle. So if you do a 360, you start back where you started, okay? She probably meant to say 180, but she's too dumb to know that. And so this stupidity of her passes over when it comes to military matters. Scholz has made it quite clear, nope, we're not sending any. The German legislature has voted overwhelmingly to say, nope, not getting involved. So, they keep, there's a complete disconnect between some of these political leaders who are hard over on supporting Zelensky in Ukraine and the actual political base that they're supposed to serve.
Le Monde reported that Macron said in a close circle that he would send the military to Odessa. Do you think that Macron is capable of doing that despite having huge disagreement in France?
Not just huge disagreement, his completely opposed by the military. The military leaked out this last week its assessment on what's really taking place in Ukraine. And it was pretty bleak. They made it very clear. Ukraine's losing and Ukraine has no way to win. And they ticked off all the different shortcomings, failings of Ukraine and the failings of the West and the limitations on troop size and ammunition production and not being able to start a wartime economy, et cetera. So, Macron was, they've been leaking to get the information out. Oh, yeah, he's threatening to put troops in. But when he did his radio interview last night, initially it was anticipated he'd be doing a speech to the French people. But he backed out on that, did a press conference in, I've heard it been described variably as shambles, a train wreck. He made Michael Jackson doing the moonwalk backwards looked like he was standing still. So Macron has sort of backed off from, oh yeah, we're going to send troops. Because Vladimir Putin's made it very clear. If you send troops, they will be considered as invaders and we will kill them. Period.
In recent public remarks, Pope Francis encouraged Ukraine to have courage of the white flag to end the Ukraine-Russia war. He faced backlash from several leading Ukrainian officials, including the head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, who emphasized that surrender is not a mindset among Ukrainians. I use today's sponsor, Ground News, to explore coverage from every side of the story. If you don't already know, Ground News, their app and website, gathers related news articles from around the world, adding context so readers can easily separate truth from propaganda. They found more than 198 articles reporting on reactions to the Pope's comments, from Ukrainian leadership to its NATO supporters. Up top, I can read a summary of this story, and down below, I can sort through all the articles to compare how the news is reporting on it. Two high factuality sources stand out. The Kiev Independent focuses on the criticism the Pope received, which was later clarified as a call for ceasefire and negotiations, not surrender. The Vatican News highlights the Pope's broader call for peace, mentioning the financial motives of the arms industry while stating that war is the power of darkness. Whether Kiev or Moscow should push for negotiations to end the war, it's important to consider both sides as casualties increase. This important context is why I follow the war on Ground News and support their goal of presenting all sides of every story and encouraging civil debate. Go to ground.news/dialogueworks to try it out. Plans start at under $1 per month, but my link gets you 40% off their unlimited access management. Larry, there is a line, there is a code in the talks of Stoltenberg, Macron. We will not allow Putin to win. In their vision, what does it mean? How they can avoid that?
Well, you need to review their, they had a much longer to-do list. So the top of that list is said, stop the sun from rising tomorrow. Stop the rain falling from rain clouds. Stop the darkness from being dark, okay? And stop Putin from winning. That's, you know, they can say whatever they want. That doesn't make it happen. They have no say in the matter. They're not determining whether Putin wins or loses. Putin determines whether Putin wins or loses with Shoigu, Gerasimov, and the rest of the Russian army. Russia is, you know, they're going back to the very basics. Produce more ammunition than the other side. Produce more guns than the other side. Sign up more people into your military ranks than the other side. Have better aircraft than the other side. Have more hypersonic missiles than the other side. Have more artillery than the other side. Have more drones than the other side. And then they're going, good God, how is Russia winning? Yeah, it's ridiculous. This refusal to deal with reality. Just let me know, it's sort of a side comment. One of the criticisms that you'll see, and it's repeated again by in the Spectator magazine, the guy just put it out, and they say, oh, Russia's got a weak military, because look, after 2 years of fighting, Russia has, they haven't taken over all of Ukraine. Okay, that's our standard. So Israel has been fighting in Gaza, much, 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 much smaller area. We're going on 6 months, and they haven't beat the Palestinians. So does that mean that, you know, would the guy at the Spectator apply the same standard to Israel? That Israel's not winning? Now, different cases. Israel's not fighting an actual organized army. They're fighting in a guerrilla insurgent force, whereas Russia's fighting a NATO-trained army and beating the stuffing out of it. That's the problem NATO faces, is they really thought at the outset that they had a proxy military force with the Ukrainians, because they'd been training them, for God's sake, over the last 8-9 years conducting annual military exercises. And then in addition to that, there were other exercise support elements and training missions that took place during the year. And they had outfitted them with weaponry of various kinds and air defense systems. And all NATO had to do is just wait for Ukraine to hit those Russians, and the Russians would flee in panic. They'd be crying all the way back to Moscow, and the West could help break up Russia into 42 states, 42 different countries, and take, you know, we get all that for us. We take the oil, we take the uranium, we take the diamonds, we take the gold, we take the nickel, the nitrogen. We want it all. We'll take it all. Didn't work out. Did not work out. They've discovered, wait a second. You remember the old Beatles song? You're too young to you're too young to remember. I remember. Give you all we got to give. Yeah, we've given all we got to give. No more to give. If right now the Germans give up all the a bunch of Taurus missiles to Ukraine, great. Germany doesn't have any more, and they can't make more to replace what they give away. So they're essentially disarming themselves.
There were very interesting articles in CNN. One says that high explosive FAB 1500 bombs capable of undermining Ukraine's defense systems. And the other article says that Russia outproduces the whole West by 3 times in terms of ammunition. When you put these two articles together, it shows the quantity and the quality of the Russian army today.
Yeah.
And yeah. If that's the case that they're reporting on, why they're not trying to negotiate with Russia?
Oh, to negotiate with Russia, you have to admit that you're wrong. You know, I started rereading a book by Tim Weiner called Legacy of Ashes. And if anybody out there has not read it, I really encourage you to go back and read it. It tells the history of the first 60 years of the CIA. And what's fascinating is when you go back to the early days of the CIA, they had, you had a lot of people who didn't speak Russian, who had never lived in Russia, who didn't speak a lot of foreign languages, for that matter, and didn't have a lot of experience overseas except in World War II. And that was with American fighting units, not necessarily going out and living with the locals and knowing how to, you know, understand the cultural differences and the experience of, you know, being with the Poles or being with the Yugoslavs or being with Russians. And what you realize is just such a gross misunderstanding and ignorance of what the Soviets were, and still to this day, what the Russians are, what they're doing, why they're doing what they're doing. And there was the intelligence gaps that have existed for decades, where the United States, you know, they had no idea that the Russians were, the Soviets were on the verge of getting the atomic bomb when they did. Oh, we didn't know that because we didn't have any human intelligence that had penetrated the inner circles of the Russian military or Stalin's clique. And that's still the situation today with respect to the Russian army, the Russian Navy, the Russian Air Force, and with Vladimir Putin. You know, it's almost, and this would never happen, but I'd like to propose a program where Russia and the United States and China, they each sit down and agree that they're going to send a liaison officer who will get to sit in on top secret meetings in each government and report back what's going on. That way, there wouldn't be any mystery. There wouldn't be any confusion. You wouldn't be speculating about, well, what are those damn Russians going to do today? Or how crazy is Joe Biden? You'd have a full unfettered information back and forth. So you'd know and say, no, they're not, like after World War II, the fear was the false belief is that Stalin was in keen on building a world communist empire. He was going to carry it out at didn't care how many people he had to kill to get it done. When really what the Soviets were doing is they said, you know, we've been attacked now for the last 150 years by these Westerners. We're going to put as much security on our borders with friendly states that we can until we're certain that the West isn't going to try to attack us. And what did the West do? Immediately started launching an insurgency by funding Ukrainians to carry out guerrilla attacks against the Soviets. So we just convinced them that we were what they were afraid of, which is one of, you know, so you get back into this dynamic back and forth where then, you know, the Soviets crack down. The West says, see, they're tyrants, they're authoritarians. And so we get involved. And then you just get the spiral of war and regime change. And so, you know, we come back to today. There is no understanding of Russia in the West. They create this meme, which is what Macron is doing. Oh, Putin wants to conquer Europe. Really? You know, give me one example in the last 20 plus years that Putin's been in power where he's gone out and attacked other countries. So there are two. Georgia, 2008, when the Russians were attacked by the Georgians, okay? Not the other way around. And Russia then responded to that. And then February 2022, February 24th, when the Russians launched what they call their special military operation. That's it. Well, the West still wants to pretend. Russia did that out of the blue. That was completely unprovoked. No, it was absolutely, totally provoked. And when you go back and count up that, again, the number of annual military exercises the U.S. Military through EUCOM and all of NATO were conducting with the Ukrainians every year, with the Russians as the enemy in those scenarios, it's no wonder that Russia was building up its military, worried about what the West was going to do. So, again, this failure to get into the other person's shoes and understand how they look at the world is really, it's afflicted the West, because the West, there's such an arrogance in the part of the West. I mean, we're smarter, we're wealthier, we're more educated, so we say. We're better at everything than you are. All you people from, you know, the global South, you know, Brazil, you guys are probably lucky that you got shoes and used toilet paper down there, you know? So, I mean, it's that kind of arrogance that comes off.
Did you see the clip that came out of Macron talking to Zelensky on the day of commencement of a special military operation? Zelensky called Macron. He was so afraid of Russia. He said that Kiev is surrounded by Russians. And he was asking Macron for some sort of negotiations. Even Macron asked him, do you want to negotiate? He said, yes, I want to negotiate with Russia. And you see Macron coming out this way, and it's all contradictions. Nobody can understand what's going on with this guy. And even he says that he's going to talk with his ally to have some sort of solution for the conflict. But then everything went wrong since that day.
It's got to be the cocaine. I mean, I think Macron and Zelensky get together and they draw up some lines of cocaine and are snorting away. You know, they're having themselves a party. Yeah, this is, you know, Macron is, he has made himself irrelevant. He's made these cheap threats. Putin's called him out on those threats. He's now gone to Germany to meet with Scholz and with Tusk. And, you know, I don't know what those three boneheads are going to come up with, but it's not going to be good. The facts are very, very simple. Nobody in Europe and all of Europe combined cannot fight and defeat Russia. They don't have the military force and capability that Russia does. They don't have the Air Force. They don't have the missiles. They've proven that their tanks are a complete joke. You know, I said in half in jest that the other day with, I forget who I was talking to, maybe it was with Judge Napolitano, but that they ought to have a contest between the American M1 Abrams, the British Challenger, the French Leopard, or was it the German Leopard, and see which one burns the brightest and burns the longest when it gets hit with an anti-tank guided missile. No, because we saw the one with the Challenger took a British news crew out. Hey, let's go for a spin. We'll show you how this thing works. Sunk in the mud. Not going anywhere. It's now a fixed artillery emplacement. So, Europe doesn't have, in fact, they got all these different varieties of equipment, moreover, which means maintenance is difficult. Producing spare parts is made even more difficult. So, you know, they can say all the bad words they want toward him and call Putin names, but the time's going to come where they're going to have to sit down and say, okay, we got to negotiate. We can't afford a war with Russia. And the hatred of Russia, again, it's irrational. They keep accusing them, keep accusing Russia of doing what the West has done consistently. You know, the one country in the world that's been involved with more regime change and interference in foreign elections is the United States. Hell, we just yesterday got Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer. There need to be new elections in Israel. Get rid of that Netanyahu character. All Schumer did was ensure that Netanyahu's going to be around for a long while, because by attacking Netanyahu, a foreigner attacking Netanyahu, it boosts his support in Israel. It doesn't hurt it. Crazy. But, you know, the bottom line is the malevolent force in the world has been the United States, not Russia.
When it comes to the Nuland's departure, some people think that she wanted her position to be upgraded.
Well, okay, look, we've heard opinions all over the map. The majority of people believe that, quote, Victoria Nuland was pushed. She was forced from office. But several of us, you know, I know Professor Mearsheimer myself. No, I think she jumped. And I think we got further evidence that she jumped because she had a job already lined up at Columbia University. Now, if I called you up tomorrow and said, hey, Nima, you're fired. Get out of here. I'm not talking to you anymore. Oh, what do you do? You'd have to be looking for a new job or, you know. Well, Victoria Nuland had the best job at State Department as Undersecretary for Political Affairs, other than being Secretary of State. They pushed this story that, oh, she so wanted to be Deputy Secretary, and they didn't name her Deputy Secretary, and that was a real blow. Oh, bollocks. That's nonsense. Being Deputy Secretary is really a meaningless job unless the Secretary falls over dead. So if Nuland, I don't think she wanted to go give up being Undersecretary of Political Affairs to become a Deputy Secretary, which is, you know, it's not that meaningful of a post. You're not the main player unless the Secretary of State turns to you and says, here, I want you to take charge of this or do that or the other thing. Whereas the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, all of the key bureaus at State, you know, the Bureau, the Mideast Bureau, the Southeast Asia Bureau, Near East South Asia, the China Bureau, Europe, Russia, Latin America, you know, South America, Mexico, that all reported to her. And so, you know, I think what was driving this is she's looking at the support for the Ukrainian effort. It's drying up. And the support for what is, you know, Ukraine's going to always be in second place or third place after Middle East and China. That's just the fact now. It's not going to be the number one priority. I'm going to get out of here before this thing goes south and I get blamed. I think that's exactly what happened. They're putting more emphasis, trying to put emphasis on China, but, you know, in a curious way, they've tried to downplay some of the confrontational language that was, prevalent about a year ago. Well, why would that be? Well, they got their hands full right now with respect to Israel and the Houthis in Yemen. I mean, you know, here we are. See, so January, February, March, 3 months. We're going on 4 months that the Houthis standing up to the U.S. Navy. We can't launch enough bombs. Excuse me. Bombs on them. And yet, there's still fighting.
How do you see the situation right now in Ukraine? We know that there are some disagreements right now between the foreign minister, Ukrainian foreign minister, and Zelensky. And the brother of mayor of Kiev said that if we can replace Zelensky, of course it's possible to replace Zelensky as well.
Well, okay, so let's break it down. Does Zelensky now have stronger advocate and support at State Department than he did 2 weeks ago? No. Victoria Nuland was willing to bake him cookies and take him cookies, okay? So they no longer can count on her. The people that are running the policy at State don't have the visibility and clout that Victoria Nuland had. Within Ukraine itself, you're seeing growing fissures, rifts between the various political actors. So, you know, Klitschko, Poroshenko, the former president, been very outspoken against Zelensky. And Zelensky's, creating his own problems. You know, for example, he's postponed elections that should be taking place in May, but not going to have those. Going to use the war as an excuse not to have the elections. He's still locking up political opponents. They're still forcibly dragooning people off the streets and to make them join the military against their will. And the economic aid from the United States is held up. Aid from Europe continues to trickle in, but it's not such an amount to make a significant difference. So he's got problems. I think he's growing more isolated. And yet, in that isolation, he's probably gotten more belligerent. He went last week, met with Erdogan in Turkey. And Erdogan apparently was pushing him on the negotiations issue. And Zelensky told him to go have sex with your mother, Mr. Erdogan, you know. But said it in a much more crude fashion. But, you know, so he's not listening to advice from people who are, you know, in a position to maybe help him or try to get, you know, get Russia to make some concessions.
There is an article in the Telegraph that says that European NATO members should prepare for a scenario in which US withdraws from the alliance. How close to the reality is this article and why they're talking about this right now? What's the agenda behind this type of articles?
Well, they're preparing for the possible victory of Donald Trump in November. Trump wins, NATO's done. The reality is, even if Trump doesn't win, NATO's done. NATO has no reason for being, no raison d'être, because it was initially created on a lie. The lie was we got to stand NATO up to be able to be ready to fight off a Soviet invasion, where they'd come through the Fulda Gap with tanks roaring and take over all of Europe. Well, that was never the plan of the Soviets. But they reacted, you know, NATO was created. And then the Soviets said, oh, yeah? Well, we're going to create the Warsaw Pact. So there. So created the Warsaw Pact. And then each side used the other side's organization to justify, though, that's why we need to spend more money because Those guys got the Warsaw Pact. No, no, those guys got NATO. We need to build up. So, you know, get the cycle going. Soviet Union collapse. Warsaw Pact goes away. NATO looks around and goes, oh, well, we got to do something. I know, let's expand. Soviets no longer are a threat. Russia's weak militarily. Yeah, we need to expand. Why? Oh, there'll be a bigger threat from Russia. No, no, it's terrorism. It's terrorism. That's right. We got to fight global terrorism. Need to expand. Kept expanding and expanding. But there, you know, it's a paper organization. Europe doesn't need a standing European army. Because whose standards are you going to use? German? French? British? Polish? Norwegian? Swiss? Netherlands? Italy? Spain? Portugal? You know, I keep going on. The Czech Republic, the Slovak Republic, Romania, Hungary. Who gets to decide whose standards of military training that everybody's going to adhere to? You either have that, or you tell everybody, okay, we're all in this together, guys. You do your thing, you do your thing, and then we'll occasionally exercise it and hope it all works. It's just, it's, you know, NATO needs to go away. And the Europeans, they need to work out a deal with Russia where, you know, they'll have their national guards, their militia, like Switzerland, for self-defense, national self-defense. But candidly, the only reason the French and the Germans and the Brits had these large standing armies and the British and French had these big navies was because they were colonialists. They were eager on conquering and controlling other countries outside of their own country. And that era is ending. It's come to an end. It's in the process of dying, and we're sort of seeing the last embers of that, you know, once mighty global empire burn down and fade away.
Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski said that NATO troops are already in Ukraine. Is he trying to normalize sending more troops to Ukraine?
Sikorski's got a big mouth. I'm sure that's what the Biden administration's saying. Remember, he's the same guy that after the Nord Stream pipeline blew up, he was tweeting out, hey, America, way to go. You know, thumbs up there, guys. Everybody looked around and go, what? I think we need to recognize that he's a bit of a loose cannon. So, yeah, are there NATO personnel inside Ukraine fighting with the Ukrainians? Yeah. They're probably operating HIMARS, operating Patriot missile batteries, and are probably dying in the process as Russia targets those. You've got intelligence analysts and personnel that are working out of the various command centers where they're assembling the overhead, the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance information, and putting that together for target packages. So, yeah, they're there. They're just not there in a great volume, and they're not there under NATO command. They've been sheep-dipped. In other words, they've created the illusion that they're actually civilians, even though they still are responsive to military command from their own chains of command. I think that they're trying to see if they can come up with a coherent message, because it's like everything that Macron said, Scholz disagreed with and contradicted. And Poland, I can see them in the position of saying, hey, guys, well, we're out here on the pointy end of the spear. We're right next to Ukraine. And if things go south, we're going to have problems. Plus, you know, Poland's got at least one of the two missile batteries that have been taken off of a U.S. Destroyer and placed on ground on the land. So it's capable potentially of firing a nuclear weapon. So, and then, you know, they've been used as a training base as well. So, you know, Poland's nervous, and I think they're wanting to make sure they get Germany and France on the same sheet of music, that they're all singing the same tune. I don't know if it's possible. Because I think Scholz and Macron, in fact, their various positions have them pretty far apart.
I saw that you wrote a piece on your website, sonar21.com. The title is Why is the European Union Destroying Its Own Economy? What's the point of this piece?
That wasn't me that wrote that. That was a guy, maybe the name of Gaia Spaltar. But the purpose of the piece was just to point out that all of economic theory, and if you've taken introduction to economics or even advanced economics courses, all economics is premised upon the notion that people are rational actors, that you're going to act in your own best interest. You're not going to act in your own worst interest. Of course, we know from other things that that's not true. You know, a lot of people will smoke cigarettes every day, 2 or 3 packs a day. Well, it's bad for you. So you're not making the optimal choice for your health. Or others like to really eat donuts and sugar and make themselves into a diabetic. Well, the same thing applies to nations. You think nations are going to make the rational choice. And yet here is Germany aligning itself so closely with the West that when the West blows up a pipeline that's critical for Germany's survival as an industrial power, Germany goes, oh, okay, no big deal. You know, basically, it was an act of war. And part of that's explained by the fact that Germany is under the control, political control right now, of the Green Party. Man, the Green Party would have everybody collecting, drying out cow manure, and maybe burning that for fuel. But they don't want to use any fossil fuels, God forbid. No oil, no gas. Of course, you know, all these Green Party clowns, they're driving cars and using gas and, you know, have lots of plastics that are made from oil, petroleum products. Wear it, you know, buy it, live with it. So, you know, the hypocrisy is strong. So what you've got, though, is Europe making these economic decisions that are self-destructive. And they're not doing anything to correct it. You know, Russia was one of their major trading partners. Ditto for Japan. So if they're going to isolate Russia and then potentially crack down on Japan, on China, then you've got, Europe sort of cutting its own throat, because Europe doesn't make a lot of products that the world is clamoring for. But Europe is buying and importing a lot from China and from Russia, or used to. So you don't have, they don't, there's not ready alternatives to those.
Pope Francis has said that the losing side in the conflict in Ukraine should find the courage to admit and agree to negotiations. How did you find this comment, and what was the reactions in the West?
In America and in the EU, some of them paid lip service like, oh, great, the Pope weighed in. But Zelensky, who's Jewish, not Catholic, blew it off, ignored it. And it really didn't resonate much within the rest of Ukraine either, because although Ukraine is Catholic, you know, a large percentage of the Western Ukraine is Catholic as opposed to Eastern Orthodox, they still didn't embrace it. And, you know, the rest of the West, he said it, but notice the hypocrisy. He's not saying anything similar about Gaza, where, you know, there's just as much of a horror of carnage is going on as in Ukraine. So, his selective moral outrage can be, I think he's largely being ignored. People are not clamoring saying, yeah, the Pope said this, let's take to the streets, let's protest, let's, you know, shut down normal traffic and movement in Washington and London and Berlin and Paris. That's not happening.
It's so amazing to see CIA Director Bill Burns. He was one of the people who, before this conflict started, said that the entry of Ukraine in NATO would be the brightest of all red lines for Russia. Yeah. Right now, he's asking, after these 20 months of this conflict, he's asking for more ammunition, more aid to Ukraine. Even he's suggesting to bomb Crimea. How did you find this transformation of this guy? Because this was once very wise, and right now he's suggesting something unbelievable.
It's mystifying. You know, he went from saying niet means niet, no means no, to now it's da, 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 yes, 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 all the time. I know a Russian intelligence officer who was active in the KGB when the Soviets were the Soviets, and was busy traveling, working as a translator, with meetings with like Yasser Arafat, Muammar Gaddafi, Mubarak, and Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. And you know, I know that this Russian intelligence officer had frequent contact at one point with Bill Burns when Burns was in a particular location. I mean, they hung out together, they talked together, they had, you know, meals together. So I give that as background, that Burns is not a stupid guy. He's not lacking in intellect, he's not lacking in experience. But to say and do what he's doing, it's beyond delusional. It's the stuff that you would expect of someone who was mentally ill doing. Let's come back to sort of one of the maybe saving graces. I just saw the annual intelligence assessment on U.S. national security published. Ray McGovern flagged a couple of things to me. The CIA concluded that Iran is nowhere near getting a nuke, and that Iran was not involved, nor did it have foreknowledge of the attacks on October 7th. So I give Burns credit there. At least it looks like they're calling some of it straight. They're not pandering to the political theater that is dominating the Biden White House. But still, for him, Burns not to recognize that there's no way Ukraine can win this, no way. And that the risk that the West runs if they continue to try to put personnel and equipment, personnel into Ukraine, and then equipment giving long-range missiles that can hit inside Russia into the hands of the Ukrainians, they're just increasing the risk that this war is going to expand, and that NATO countries like France and Germany and Poland will find themselves directly embroiled in the battle, and it will cost them dearly. They'll lose.
We know that Russian Navy had joint warship exercises with Iran and China Gulf of Oman. How do you see these three countries getting together again? How close they are right now in terms of their military?
Well, this has been going on now for 5 years. So this wasn't the first time. So it shows that they put a high priority value on conducting this annual exercise, usually February or March timeframe. And it sends a clear message that in the event of any Western attack on Iran, they may have to contend with Russia and China. And nobody in the West, I think, really wants to do that.
When it comes to Gaza and the situation right now, we see that they were pushing these guys to Rafah, and right now they're attacking Rafah. It's so unbelievable when you look at the pictures. You talk about Chuck Schumer talking about, let's get rid of Netanyahu and his administration, but yeah. Who's going to replace him? Who's going to change this policy in Rafah, in Gaza?
Well, nobody. Nobody. I mean, that's the point. If they get rid of Netanyahu and bring in Benny Gantz, yeah, he's, quote, liberal. He's not conservative. He'll get rid of some of the more obnoxious Zionists like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. But he's not going to change policy. He's as much opposed to a two-state solution as Netanyahu. And he's as supportive of the military operation is Netanyahu. The problem Israel faces right now is that even with this, you know, going after the Palestinians down there, they may force all, they may make Gaza uninhabitable in terms of nobody can live there, nobody can engage with normal commerce, nobody can go to school, raise a family, eke out some sort of economic existence. This is going to be a, like a desert, an urban desert, self-created. That doesn't mean that Hamas is going to be eliminated. Hamas can, well, then could, you know, particularly if it's largely devoid of civilians, Hamas will still, I think, be largely in control of that territory and move in such ways that they will constantly be ambushing Israelis, and Israelis will be dying. But that, I think Israel's focus is shifting. Yeah, they're going to continue to bomb the civilians in Rafah and force them out. But their real objective is to take on Hezbollah and get Hezbollah out of northern Israel so that the Israeli settlers can come back there.
Do you see that this conflict between Israel and Hezbollah getting better? Is it getting worse? How do you see?
It's going to get worse. Hezbollah has been careful not to move too far, too fast to really provoke Israel. But Israel seems quite intent on provoking Hezbollah. Hezbollah's use of missiles, rockets along the northern border have basically cleared out about 1 million settlers from the various kibbutzim that are up there. And those people, that 1 million people, they're clamoring to go, we want to go back to our home. We want to go back to our land. Well, the only way Israel can guarantee that is they've got to go into Lebanon, push Hezbollah north of the Litani River, and then hopefully hold the Hezbollah back from there. I don't think they can do it. I don't think militarily they can accomplish that. They're going to try. They've been warning about it since January. So we're coming up on 4 months now. So they're going to do it. It's just a matter of how long they'll be able to sustain their operation or how quick it'll be before Hezbollah beats them.
Harry, just to wrap up this session, I want to know your opinion on the U.S. military forces in Syria. They were talking about that. It's time to get out of Syria right now. It seems that they're staying there. How do you find the current situation in that region?
Well, they serve no military purpose other than to protect oil. So they're a big fat target. So far, for whatever reason, the Iranian-backed groups look like they've backed off of attacking those military positions. So maybe that's because there's been a secret deal cut. They'll say, hey, stop attacking us for a month and we'll pull out. We don't want to look like we're being forced out. And, you know, I could see the Arab and Muslim supporters go, all right, well, if that's that's what they're saying, if that's the deal, we'll give it a shot, see what happens. But there is absolutely no reason for U.S. forces to be there in Syria.